Today is Friday, May 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Alexandria, Virginia. Observers say the threat of nuclear proliferation in the Middle East cannot be ignored and must be tackled.
Iran seems to be pursuing its own maximum pressure campaign against the Biden administration in an effort to gain concessions at the negotiating table on the nuclear deal.
Plus, the U.S. Secretary of State said on a visit to Ukraine, Russia remains poised to take aggressive action on fairly short notice. We'll have these stories and more next. Negotiations continue on a U.S. return to the Iran nuclear deal and on how to ensure its full and effective implementation. Observers say the threat of nuclear proliferation in the Middle East cannot be ignored and must be tackled, even as Iran demands an end to crippling U.S. sanctions. But as Dale Gavlek reports, analysts also say that the wide-ranging activities of Iran-backed Shiite militias and missiles in the region need to be addressed.
David Scheniger is a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and a former Trump administration Middle East advisor. He and other observers say Iran is desperate for sanctions relief as it demands all sanctions be lifted before it returns to compliance with the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA. But Scheniger argues that the U.S. should leverage the current talks also to deal with Iran's malign behavior and that of its proxies in the region.
If enough sanctions are lifted, there'll be insufficient leverage to get the Iranians to discuss any of the other elephants in the room, that is, the missiles and the Iranian-backed Shiite militias that are running amok in the Middle East. From Iraq to Yemen to Syria to Lebanon, Iran seems to be pursuing its own maximum pressure campaign against the Biden administration in an effort to gain concessions at the negotiating table on the nuclear deal.
He points to recent attacks on the U.S. military bases in Iraq, increasing drone attacks on Saudi Arabia by Yemen's Houthi rebels, despite the Biden administration's delisting of the Houthis as a terror group, and Iranian fast boats harassing U.S. naval vessels in the Persian Gulf. However, Financial Times International Affairs editor David Gardner, in remarks made to Columbia University's Global Center, said he sees a weakened Iran through crippling sanctions, failed regional adventures, and the loss of its chief military strategist, Qasem Soleimani, and a U.S. airstrike in Iraq last year. This is the case, he said, despite Iran's sphere of influence in the so-called Shiite crescent.
Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, this is not an arc, an axis of power. It's an arc of failed states, which Iran increasingly struggles to manage, especially post-Qasem Soleimani. It's not possible to proceed purely on that hard power formula of militias and missiles. The need for sanctions relief is very, very pressing.
David Hirst, editor-in-chief of Middle East Eye, agrees.
The assassination of Soleimani has had really quite a devastating effect on the coordination of different groups. No one has been able to replace Soleimani, who was a military general. He spoke Arabic. He built bridges, not just with the Kurds, but with Sunni Arab leaders. Him suddenly going has demonstrated the weakness of the structure.
Still, London's International Institute of Strategic Studies says recent satellite imagery shows the construction of a new set of seven silos storing advanced new missiles in southern Iran that could pose concern for military air bases in Saudi Arabia and Bahrain. Others point to Iran-linked Iraqi militias muscling in on a strategic region that connects Iraq and Syria following the Islamic State militants' defeat. Dale Gavlek for VOA News, Amman.
A senior State Department official speaking on a call with reporters Thursday said that the last three rounds of discussions with Iran have helped to crystallize the choices that need to be made by Iran and by the United States to return to mutual compliance with the JCPOA. The official added that if Iran is not prepared to do that, the Biden administration will deal with the situation and will do everything it can to make sure that Iran does not acquire nuclear weapons. The decision by Russia to pull back some military forces from the Ukraine border last month ended a standoff that alarmed Western capitals. But the U.S. Secretary of State said on a visit to Ukraine, Russia remains poised to take aggressive action on fairly short notice. Reuters' Matthew LaRotonda is up next.
The U.S. government says that it may increase the amount of security assistance that it offers to Ukraine in light of the two countries' continued problems with Russia. Moscow's decision to pull back some of its forces from the Ukraine border last month helped end a standoff that made alarm bells ring in Western capitals and set the stage for an expected summit between Presidents Biden and Putin. But speaking alongside Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky in Kyiv on Thursday, Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Russia remains poised to take what he called aggressive action on short notice.
We're aware that Russia has withdrawn some forces from the border of Ukraine, but we also see that significant forces remain there, significant equipment remains there. We're monitoring the situation very, very closely.
President Zelensky said he's been impressed by the Biden administration's awareness of the situation and asked for NATO to strengthen its presence in the region. Blinken didn't specify what form an increase in aid could take, but last week, Ukraine's foreign minister said that it was asking for air defense systems and technology that can counter snipers. The military standoff last month prompted Zelensky's government to lobby the United States and Europe to speed up Ukraine's possible admittance into the NATO alliance. Ukraine says 14,000 people have died over 7 years of fighting with separatists who are backed by Russia.
Matthew LaRotonda from Reuters News. Top U.S. defense and military officials are holding out hope the Afghan government will be able to withstand the latest Taliban military offensive. Attacks by the Taliban were launched as U.S. and coalition troops began packing up and leaving the country. Provincial officials from across Afghanistan have warned of mounting losses in a series of attacks, some with heavy casualties since the United States officially began its withdrawal on May 1st. At a news conference, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin says Afghanistan's security forces are capable, but face a tough road without U.S. support on the ground.
They have a pretty significant capability, but it's going to, you know, we expect that this will be a challenge for them.
The Pentagon insisted that the withdrawal was going according to plan with no surprises. Some U.S. officials and outside experts, however, warn that the withdrawal of some 2,500 to 3,500 U.S. forces and almost 7,000 coalition troops, along with tens of thousands of contractors, will put the capabilities of the Afghan security forces to the test. How the U.S. will help the Afghan military and the Afghan Air Force remains unclear, but Joint Chiefs Chairman Mark Milley says supporting the Afghan Air Force is a vital task.
Maintaining logistic support to the Afghan Air Force is a key task that we have to sort out, doing it over the horizon, but also in country. It could be done by contractors. A lot of that's going to be dependent on the conditions, the security conditions on the ground. But the intent is to keep the Afghan Air Force in the air and to provide them with continued maintenance support.
A key U.S. government watchdog, the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, said in a report last week that the Afghan Air Force could be grounded within months without the current level of contractor support. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. A new attempt to estimate the coronavirus pandemic's true death toll puts the number at more than double the official tally. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani explains.
University of Washington researchers estimate the actual number of deaths globally is 6.9 million people. They also suggest the U.S. death count is more than 905,000, while the official tally is about 575,000. The estimates are the latest bid to get a handle on something that's hard to count. Experts say the official COVID-19 death statistics are undercounted for several reasons, like governments perhaps missing deaths that did not happen in hospitals or cases where a patient did not have a COVID test. Sagar Magani, Washington.
In addition, vaccine developers Pfizer and BioNTech say that they will donate doses to inoculate athletes and officials preparing for the Tokyo Olympics. AP correspondent Charles de la Desma has that story.
The International Olympic Committee says delivery of doses is set to begin this month to give delegations time to be fully vaccinated with a second shot before arriving for the Games, which open on July 23. The new Pfizer offer gives greater coverage worldwide ahead of Tokyo, with most countries yet to authorize emergency use of Chinese vaccines. In March, the IOC had agreed with officials in China to buy and distribute its vaccines ahead of the Tokyo Games and then the Winter Games. IOC President Thomas Bach says he hopes athletes will lead by example and accept the vaccine where and when possible. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
The World Health Organization warns that African countries risk a new wave of coronavirus infections because of the slow rollout of life-saving vaccines and the circulation of new variants. Lisa Schlein has those details.
The WHO reports the epidemic curve in Africa has plateaued for 6 weeks, with the number of cases now standing at more than 4.5 million, including 123,000 deaths. The UN Health Agency, however, reports the relatively low number of cases is giving rise to complacency and non-compliance with preventive measures such as masking and social distancing. The WHO Regional Director for Africa, Matshidiso Moeti, says the greatest threat to the spread of the infection and a resurgence of cases are due to delays and shortages of vaccine supplies.
African countries are slipping further behind the rest of the world in the COVID-19 vaccine rollout, now accounting for only 1% of the vaccines administered worldwide, down from 2% a few weeks ago. Only around half of the 37 million doses shipped to the continent have been administered so far.
COVID-19 is the disease caused by the coronavirus. Moeti says African countries need to step up and do their part to get the available shots into people's arms fast. So far, the COVAX vaccine sharing program has delivered some 80 million doses to Africa. COVAX officials say vaccine deliveries from the Serum Institute of India were halted in March because of the dramatic resurgence of COVID-19 in India. This, they note, has resulted in a shortfall of 140 million doses as India uses the vaccines to inoculate its population. South Africa and India are leading efforts at the World Trade Organization for a temporary waiver on intellectual property rights that are preventing the mass production of generic COVID-19 vaccines. Moeti says she welcomes the U.S. decision to shore up these efforts.
I'd like to add my voice in praising the United States' decision to support a temporary waiver on patent protections for COVID-19 vaccines and treatments, which could mark a game changer for Africa, unlocking millions more doses and saving countless more lives.
Moeti says the sooner negotiations are wrapped up, the sooner the manufacture and rollout of safe and effective vaccines can take place. In the meantime, she says, one of the quickest and surest ways to save lives is for countries to share their surplus stock of vaccines with countries in need. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Hopes that India's rampaging second wave of COVID-19 is peaking were set back on Thursday as record daily infections and deaths were reported as the virus spread from cities to villages that were poorly equipped to cope. India's health ministry reported a record 412,262 new cases and 3,980 deaths reported during the preceding day, taking total infections past the 21 million mark and the overall death toll to 230,168. While the capital, New Delhi, and several other cities have been hardest hit so far, limited public health care, including a dearth of testing facilities, means the threat is grave in rural areas that are home to nearly 70% of the country's nearly 1.4 billion people. The United Nations said its team on the ground continues supporting authorities to tackle the pandemic. UN spokesperson Stéphane Dujarric said UNICEF, the World Health Organization, and the UN Population Fund have delivered nearly 10,000 oxygen concentrators, nearly 10 million medical masks, and more than 1.5 million face shields. The UN team has also purchased ventilators and oxygen-generating plants. Medical charity Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, said on Wednesday that malnutrition is taking a toll in Ethiopia's conflict-torn Tigray region as many people are being cut off from humanitarian aid. The group says some people are eating just one meal a day and that some areas are experiencing levels of acute malnutrition well above the emergency threshold. Now for more, VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke to MSF Emergency Programs Manager Marie Carmen Vignoles.
Unfortunately, what we are seeing is an increased level of malnutrition and alarming in several locations. What we have seen is a trend, and what we have seen is that there are more cases now than what we were seeing some months ago. And we are very much concerned that if the food distributions are not effective, reaching all the people in need in all the areas, we can, in some weeks from now, we are going to see even more increase of malnutrition cases. We are seeing malnutrition cases in children, but as well in pregnant breastfeeding mothers.
And what does this mean? Is this reaching to where some people are dying from malnutrition, or is it still at a lower stage?
We are not reaching that level yet, but it's true that in certain locations, we see quite a lot of children that they are malnourished. And if they don't receive medical attention, if they don't receive the proper health care that they need, and if they don't receive as well enough food distributions, their families, then they will die because of complications. So yes, these malnourished children, they need access to health care. The numbers of malnourished kids, they are above the emergencies. Doesn't mean that we have reached already, fortunately, the famine, but it means that it's alarming, which means that the action needs to happen today.
And so what's the issue? What is preventing the proper food distributions and access to medical care from reaching these people?
Our teams, they are the ones in MSF that we do these mobile clinics, and we try to provide healthcare as much as possible to rural communities. It has been the ongoing conflict and the ongoing insecurity. This is what is preventing to be able to reach all the places in need. We are not in charge of doing food distribution, so we cannot say what has been the reasons why they are not reaching everywhere. But what I can tell you is that what we are definitely insisting and discussing with all the actors is that the food distributions need to be improve the quality and improve the quantity. Unfortunately, not all the areas are receiving and the food distributions are not reaching everybody in need.
So the fighting has been going on in Tigray for more than 6 months now. What does that look like now? Is your access getting worse lately because of that, or is it staying steady? What's going on there?
What I can say, unfortunately, is that still the situation in many of these rural places is still it's dramatic. People is in dire need. Still, there is a lot of instability and there is a lot of insecurity still ongoing.
And moving forward, the planting season is coming soon, which, of course, is crucial anywhere on Earth so that people have a harvest and can eat. What are your concerns as fighting continues with the planting season coming soon?
Yeah, so this is definitely one of the things that we are more concerned, because it's key for the population, it's key for the rural communities that they are able to do the planting season. They need to have access to the field. And in order this to happen, we need the fighting to stop. If the planting season is lost, we are very much concerned of what could be the consequences that we will see and in the population in the next 2-3 months from now.
Mari Carmen Vignoles is the emergency program manager for Doctors Without Borders. She was speaking with VOA's Jason Patinkin. The United Nations said Thursday it had released $65 million for humanitarian aid in Ethiopia, including $40 million for the Tigray region. The UN said that the remaining $25 million will fund aid operations in the rest of Ethiopia, including a response to drought in the Somali and Oromia regions. It said the funds will be used to treat children with severe acute malnutrition, rehabilitate water systems, and supply water to drought-affected communities, and to pre-position humanitarian supplies. Now, in related news, the head of Ethiopia's Tigray region government has resigned. That's according to a deputy on Wednesday who did not give any additional details. Mulunega was appointed head of the federal government-appointed interim administration in November during a military offensive launched in the northern region after regional forces attacked its bases there. Abebe Gebreyesus Yedego told Reuters News of his resignation, but Nega did not respond to phone calls seeking comment. Ethiopia's parliament also on Thursday designated the former ruling party of Tigray a terrorist organization, a move critics fear could stoke persecution and frustrate efforts to assist those in the conflict-ridden region. The resolution passed overwhelmingly in the parliament dominated by the ruling party, which also applied the terrorist designation to the Oromo Liberation Army, an armed group active in other parts of the country. Britain withdrew its Royal Navy vessels from the waters off Jersey Thursday, but said that it would remain on standby to support the Channel Island after a dispute with France over post-Brexit fishing rights escalated rapidly. France and Britain both deployed maritime patrol vessels to the area after a flotilla of French trawlers sailed in protest to Jersey's main harbor, and a French minister suggested earlier the week that Paris might cut electricity to the island. French fishermen say that they are being unfairly deprived of access to rich fishing grounds off the coast of Jersey, a self-governing British crown dependency. Jersey says it's following the rules for issuing licenses set out in Britain's post-Brexit trade deal with the European Union. Britain said it backed Jersey. The EU called for calm.
This is Science in a Minute.
The Chinese National Space Administration says it successfully put the first module of its new space station into orbit on April 28th. The space agency used its Long March 5B heavy lift launch vehicle to place the 22.6 metric ton module into space. Once a booster finishes its job, it is usually safely disposed of. Space experts say the now orbiting Long March 5B rocket is in what they call an uncontrolled reentry, meaning it's falling to Earth to an unknown crash site. Experts say that at least part of the huge piece of space junk should burn up as it blazes through the atmosphere on its way to Earth. The amount of debris left to impact Earth is unknown. The U.S. Space Command is tracking the rocket and is saying its debris should return to Earth around May 8th. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The novel coronavirus has battered the global film industry, but that hasn't stopped an annual Paris-based Black Film Festival from opening this week. And for the first time, virtually. Lisa Bryan reports this year's edition of Nollywood Week is also breaking new ground in other ways.
Bonjour, tu as entendu la nouvelle? La Nollywood Week passe en mode virtuel. Ultimo.
This eighth edition of the Nollywood Week Film Festival is traveling beyond Nigeria's powerhouse film industry to include, for the first time, movies from other parts of Africa and the Black diaspora.
Boys! Boys, boys, boys!
You really need to stop worrying about that.
Nollywood Week usually takes place at Paris's L'Alicant movie theater. But with cinemas across France still shuttered by the pandemic, the festival is going virtual with its new global content to now reach a global audience as well.
We've seen that there's been a lot of development in other cinemas, in the film industry, and a lot of other African countries that are really inspired by what's happening in Nollywood.
Shakira McIntosh is the festival's Dakar-based spokeswoman, and one of the festival's film selections is from Senegal.
People are looking at these big Nollywood films getting onto Netflix, and you know they're saying with their means, or not that much means actually, they can manage to do really quality things and tell great stories.
Nollywood Week will air nearly three dozen movies, animations, and documentaries from countries like Tanzania, Mozambique, Brazil, and Trinidad and Tobago. The audience can either purchase single movie passes costing under $10 or a full festival pass. Other parts of the four-day event, like conferences and master classes, are free.
Jay has decided that we should adopt a baby.
I have
have never taken things through the show without consulting you first.
The film industry overall has been hard hit by COVID-19. Nollywood alone, known for its scrappy, low-budget origins, has lost millions of dollars in ticket sales. But McIntosh says the pandemic and other global crises also have a positive side.
This is something that is so surreal in a way and so unheard of, that people are inspired to tell stories that are linked to either COVID or sort of tell stories of this unusual period in our history and how they're dealing with it. You know, we saw what was happening in the US with George Floyd, and that also opened up, I think, a room for people to think a bit about how we tell stories of Black people around the world and what platforms we use to do that.
Nollywood Week runs through Sunday. Its organizers hope next year's edition will be back at the La Luca, but also have a virtual component for its global fans. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
And finally, of the many factors contributing to climate change, one of the most alarming is the destruction of forests, which produce some of the oxygen that we breathe and store carbon. A recent report released by the World Resources Institute warns and much of the world's forest land is endangered as never before. VOA's Adam Phillips rounds us out.
The World Resources Institute report focuses on global tree cover loss in 2020, specifically trees over 5 meters tall. Liz Goldman, a WRI data and research specialist, is a lead author of the study.
And in looking at the data, we found that tropical forests lost 12.2 million hectares of tree cover. And of that, 4.2 million hectares occurred within humid primary forests, which is the size of the Netherlands. Humid primary forests are old growth forests that have high biodiversity and generally have higher levels of carbon. And so it's very concerning.
That's because when forests are cut down, burned, or otherwise destroyed, carbon that was stored in the trees gets released into the atmosphere, which contributes to climate change.
And when we looked at the loss data, we found that primary forest loss in 2020 resulted in 2.64 gigatons of CO2 emissions, and that's equivalent to 570 million cars, which is more than double the amount of cars on the road in the United States right now.
Goldman adds that scientists have already seen the visible effects of carbon emissions in some of the world's wild places.
We saw things like bark beetle infestations in Central Europe and forests in Siberia burning, including a really big peat soil area, which resulted in a huge amount of carbon. And I'm sure that you saw coverage in 2019 of all the fires that were happening in Brazil.
Deforestation was especially severe in Africa. In Cameroon, for example, tree cover loss doubled in 2020 over the previous year. And in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, home to the second largest tropical rainforest in the world, 490,000 hectares of humid forest land were destroyed. But why was so much forest land destroyed? Goldman says that shifting agriculture, where people farm land until the soil is depleted, then cut down new forest land for richer soil, is a major factor. She and other researchers speculate that COVID-19 may also be partly, if indirectly, to blame.
Some things that we were thinking about include maybe urban-rural migration due to pandemic job losses. And so they could be people arriving from cities and establishing new agriculture just to make ends meet, to feed themselves and their families, as well as increases in commodity prices could be spurring agricultural expansion in the country.
Eli Hakizumwami is WRI's country manager in the DRC. He says that to save forest land, the underlying human needs that lead to deforestation must be addressed.
We cannot neglect that these forests are hosted by poor communities, and for their survival, they use part of this forest for their survival, which means that one can also provide support to these countries so that they can have other alternatives that can reduce pressure to these forests.
Liz Goldman notes that strategies to save the forests are vital to human and environmental well-being.
Some things that could help include improving agricultural practices to secure higher yields in areas that are already under cultivation so that primary forest does not have to be cleared for additional agricultural land. Also promoting access to clean energy so that people don't have to rely on charcoal as much for cooking and for energy. And then also providing economic incentives for protecting forests and also resources for effective law enforcement where that's an appropriate option to take.
The World Resources Institute report also recommends improving forest lands near cities. Doing so can reduce flooding and mudslides caused by erosion and improve air quality. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
And that'll do it for us. You've been listening to VOA's International Edition. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Alexandria, Virginia. Be well. Be safe and have a great day.